Chapter 9, Part 2. A third common question raised when considering forgiveness is, how is forgiveness fair? I take this to be the question of justice. What about judgment? To be sure, forgiving is not suspending judgment. Forgiving is not pardoning, condoning, excusing, justifying, or ignoring the offense. To pardon is to release the offender from legal penalty. To condone is to overlook or accept an injustice. To excuse is to acknowledge the legitimate reasons for wrongdoing. To justify is to decide that, in light of the circumstances, fault is not present. To ignore the injury is to pretend it never happened, which is a form of denial. Forgiveness is none of these things. Forgiveness is judgment. Blame lays squarely on the head of the criminal. Although forgiveness gives us freedom to let go of our resentment and desire for revenge, the challenge of justice is ever before us, God forbid. Jimmy Lee Gray, but did not deliver him from prison. God forgave Jimmy Lee Gray, but did not deliver him from prison. Jesus forgave the thief on the cross, but Jesus did not command angels to rescue the thief from the cross. People can forgive, courts cannot. Justice and mercy differ. Never should we forget and leave a situation unfair. Sue, married with a mother of a young daughter, learned that she had a rare but fatal disease. According to the doctor, Sue had less than a year to live. When her husband learned of his wife's terminal illness, he grew distant. Within months, he filed for divorce, leaving his dying wife and young daughter all alone. A judge ordered child support payments to be made monthly. Several months passed, the father never made a payment. Since I served as interim pastor at Sue's church, she sought my counsel. What should I do? Forgive him? She wondered. What advice would you have given her? Should she forgive her husband and just let it go? Yes, you should forgive him, I counseled. But whatever you do, don't let him get away with not paying child support for your daughter. Think about it. Forgiveness belongs in the realm of God. Justice belongs to the realm of law. Law and gospels differ. Society depends upon law and order. Citizens must obey rules. Individuals may choose to render rules breakable if they wish. Courts cannot. Without law, chaos breaks loose like a raging forest fire. No doubt, one of Christianity's major challenges is translating the virtues of love and forgiveness into a social order built upon justice, consistency, and stability. It is far too easy to confuse pardon and forgiveness. Pardon removes the offender from legal liability. Forgiveness has no such obligation. You may forgive a wrongdoer personally while allowing the judicial system to run its course. Justice must prevail. Forgiveness redefined. Earlier, I proposed a working definition for forgiveness. Forgiveness is the removal of personal barriers within a relationship caused by wrongdoing, real or imagined. Let's now expand on the definition. The forgiveness coin has two sides. One side results from a violation of fairness. The other side stems from a response of bitterness and a burning desire to strike back. In other words, relational barriers are erected due to harm done to us, combined with a harmful response from us. Therefore, our unabridged definition of forgiveness reads as follows. Forgiveness is the removal of personal barriers within a relationship caused by wrongdoing, real or imagined. On the other hand, and resentment and a desire for revenge on the other. Resentment must be present in order to forgive, or there is nothing to forgive. Forgiveness calls for letting go of the resentment and the wish for revenge. When you have been wronged and the need to forgive is absent, either damage insufficient to merit, a crisis has occurred, or reaction to an offense never progressed beyond anger. Therefore, in order for resentment to be housed, you have had to have been wrong and the need to forgive was absent. So if anger was there, then resentment builds as well. Therefore, this calls for forgiveness. Examples for reflection. When you are stuck in a crisis of forgiveness, repentance, by the offering the party isn't necessary for you to grant forgiveness. Otherwise, the victim might become a slave to rage forever. For example, in the Old Testament, we read about Joseph, who was only 17, when his father, who loved him dearly, presented him with a coat of many colors. Joseph's brothers, seeing how the father adored their younger sibling, hated Joseph. With intense envy, they plotted to kill Joseph. Seizing the unexpected young man, the brothers threw him into the pit, into a wilderness to die. Soon a trade caravan approached, and they decided to sell Joseph into slavery instead of leaving him to die. After eventually landing in Egypt, Joseph rose to heights of power, ruling with authority surpassed by the Pharaoh. Many years later, famine ravaged the land of Canaan, and Joseph's brothers found themselves standing before him seeking food. They did not recognize the powerful figure as their younger brother, although Joseph knew immediately who they were. Would he seek revenge? Hadn't his brothers tried to murder him? Didn't they tear him away from his father and sell him a slave? Later, during the climactic encounter with his brothers, Joseph wept loudly and blurted, "I am Joseph. Is my father still alive? I am your brother Joseph, with whom you sold into Egypt. Now do not be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me here before you to preserve your life." The brothers surely froze in absolute shock and fear. The incredible story of Joseph's love and forgiveness continued with a moving reunion of the family. Joseph kissed all his brothers and wept on them, and afterwards his brothers talked with him. Soon the reunion of Joseph and Israel, his father, witnessed a river of tears as well as great rejoicing. When their father died, however, the brothers grew afraid. "What if Joseph bears a grudge against us and pays us back in full for all the wrong we did to him?" Instead, Joseph consoled his brothers, saying, "Do not be afraid, for I am in God's place. As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good. So therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones." The story concludes by noting that Joseph comforted them and spoke kindly to them. Joseph found the love and strength to forgive his brothers because he was capable of viewing the events of his life through God's eyes. His choice, after all, was fairly straightforward: become bitter or better. Again, remember, some wrongdoing is God's way of finding something greater. By inviting God into his crisis, Joseph chose wisely. Joseph's inspiring character gives forgiveness springs from love. However, where love is absent, forgiveness is impossible. If you love someone, forgiveness is possible. Could there ever come a time or an occasion when forgiveness should be denied? In Simon Wiesenthal's haunting book, The Sunflower, the author, a survivor of the Holocaust, tells the story of a young Jew who was taken from a concentration camp to hear the deathbed confession of a Nazi soldier. The soldier, an SS trooper, was haunted horribly by memories of a mass murder in which he had participated. Jewish men, women, and children, perhaps as many as 200, had been herded into a house. The doors had been locked. Machine guns had been trained on the exits. The house was set ablaze. Anyone who tried to escape had been riddled with bullets. Hand grenades had been thrown through the windows. A man clutching a small child had jumped from the second-story window. The Nazi, now who lay dying, had fired mercifully. A child with black hair and dark eyes haunted him. "I cannot die without coming clean," the soldier confessed. I left here with my guilt. "I want to die in peace," he whispered. "I've longed to talk to a Jew and beg for forgiveness from him. I know what I am asking is almost too much for you, but without your answer, I cannot die in peace." What would you have done? Did the young Jew have the responsibility of extending forgiveness to a confessing murderer? Would you have granted or denied forgiveness to the dying man? Silence filled the room as the dying soldier. Then the young Jew related, "At last, I made up my mind, and without a word, I left the room." Responses that fell short of forgiveness. Whenever we suffer an injustice, retribution and forgiveness rush to offer themselves as two opposing responses from which we may choose. Of course, we may also choose to ignore the wrong. If we ignore the wrong, we build up resentment and hate and anger. Reasons for electing to ignore any wrong may include love, retribution, fear, poor coping capabilities, or inadequate conflict management skills. In addition to ignoring a cruelty, pardoning, condoning, excusing, justifying, or forgetting are all possible reactions to violations of our persons. Some of these responses may be motivated by love, others by a sense of fairness, and still others by denial, for some unfathomable reason. As explained previously, none of these options constitute forgiveness. In order for forgiveness to occur, guilt must be established. Judgment must fall. Excuses are unacceptable. Sure, every deed has a cause, but cause doesn't remove responsibility. There is always a story, but not all stories excuse. I did what I did because. I didn't mean to do it. I couldn't help it. I was only following orders. All of these approaches hope to diminish judgment. Reasons and excuses differ. The former hold water, the latter do not. Good friends of mine lost their teenage son in an automobile accident involving alcohol and speeding on a part of another person. For the guilty driver, the car to say, "I didn't mean to do it," could never alter the fact that the accident was his fault. It is true that the death of our friend's son followed what is sometimes referred to as the law of unintended consequences. The inebriated driver surely did not intend to cause the death of an innocent person. Nonetheless, drunk driving is illegal, foolhardy, and merits strong judgment. Excuses fail, leaving in the wake of a crisis of forgiveness. Chapter 9, Part 2. A third common question raised when considering forgiveness is, how is forgiveness fair? I take this to be a question of justice. What about judgment? To be sure, forgiving is not suspending judgment. Forgiving is not pardoning, condoning, excusing, justifying, or ignoring the offense. To pardon is to release an offender from legal penalty. To condone is to overlook or accept an injustice. To excuse is to acknowledge legitimate reasons for the wrongdoing. To justify is to decide that in light of the circumstance, fault is not present. To ignore the injury is to pretend it never happened, which is a form of denial. Forgiveness is none of these things. Forgiveness is judgment. Blame lands squarely on the head of the criminal. Although forgiveness gives us the freedom to let go of our resentment and our desire for revenge, the challenge of justice is ever before us. God forgave Jimmy Lee Gray, but did not deliver him from prison. Jesus forgave the thief on the cross, but Jesus did not command the angels to rescue the thief from the cross. People can forgive, courts cannot. Justice and mercy differ. Never should we forgive and leave a situation unfair. Sue, married the mother of a young daughter, learned that she had a rare but fatal disease. According to doctors, Sue had less than a year to live. When her husband learned of his wife's terminal illness, he grew distant. Within months, he filed for divorce, leaving his dying wife and young daughter all alone. A judge ordered child support payments to be made monthly. Several months passed. The father never made a payment. Since I served as interim pastor at Sue's church, she sought my counsel. What should I do? Forgive him, she wondered. What advice would you have given her? Should she forgive her husband and just let it go? Yes, you should forgive him, I counseled. But whatever you do, don't let him get away with not paying your child support for your daughter. I think about it. Forgiveness is in the realm of God. Justice belongs in the realm of law. Law and gospel differ. Society depends upon law and order. Citizens must obey rules. Individuals may choose to render rules breakable if they wish. Courts cannot. Without law, chaos breaks loose like a raging forest fire. No doubt, one of Christianity's major challenges is translating the virtues of love and forgiveness into social order built upon justice, consistency, and stability. It is far too easy to confuse pardon and forgiveness. Pardon removes the offender from the legal liability. Forgiveness has no such obligation. You may forgive a wrongdoer personally while allowing the judicial system to run its course. Justice must prevail. forgiveness redefined. Earlier, I proposed a working definition of forgiveness. Forgiveness is the removal of personal barriers within a relationship caused by wrongdoing, real or imagined. Let's now expand the definition. Forgiveness coin has two sides. One side results from a violation of fairness. The other side stems from a response of bitterness and a burning desire to strike back. In other words, relational barriers are erected due to harm done to us, combined with a harmful response from us. Therefore, our unabridged definition of forgiveness reads as follows. Forgiveness is the removal of personal barriers within a relationship caused by wrongdoing, real or imagined. On the other hand, and resentment and a desire for rage on the other. Resentment must be present in order to forgive, or there's nothing to forgive. Forgiveness calls for letting go of the resentment and the wish for revenge. For if you don't have resentment, then there's nothing to forgive. If you haven't gotten to the anger stage, then you haven't gotten to the resentment stage. When you have been wronged and you need to forgive, the forgiveness, if it is absent, either damage is insufficient to merit a crisis, or the reaction to the offense never progressed beyond anger. Examples for reflection. When you are stuck by a crisis of forgiveness, repentance by the offending party isn't necessary for you to grant their forgiveness. Otherwise, you, the victim, might become a slave to rage forever. For example, in the Old Testament, we read about Joseph, who was only 17 when his father, who loved him dearly, presented him with a coat of many colors. Joseph's brothers, seeing how their father adored their younger sibling, hated Joseph. With intense envy, they plotted to kill Joseph. Seizing the unsuspecting young man, the brothers threw him into a pit in the wilderness to die. Soon a trade caravan approached, and they decided to sell Joseph into slavery instead of him dying, leaving him to die. After eventually landing in Egypt, Joseph rose to heights of power, ruling with authority surpassed only by the Pharaoh. Many years later, famine ravaged the land of Canaan, and Joseph's brother found themselves standing before him, seeking food. They did not recognize the powerful figure as their younger brother, although Joseph knew them immediately. Would he seek revenge? Hadn't his brothers tried to murder him? Didn't they tear him away from his father and sell him into slavery? Later, during the climactic encounter with his brothers, Joseph wept loudly and blurted out, "I am Joseph. Is my father still alive? I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. Now do not be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve your life and our father's." The brothers surely froze in absolute shock and fear. The incredible story of Joseph's love and forgiveness continued with a moving reunion of the family. Joseph kissed all his brothers and wept on them, and afterwards his brothers talked with him. Soon the reunion of Joseph and Israel, his father, witnessed a river of tears as well as great as rejoicing. When their father died, however, the brothers grew afraid. What if Joseph bears a grudge against us and pays us back in full for all the wrong which we did to him? Instead, Joseph consoled his brothers, saying, "Do not be afraid, for I am in God's place. As for you, you meant evil against me. God turned that evil and meant it for good. So therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones." The story concludes with Joseph noting, comforted them and spoke kindly to them. Joseph found the love and strength to forgive his brothers because he was capable of seeing the events of his life through God's eyes. His choice, after all, was fairly straightforward: become bitter or become better. By inviting God into his crisis, Joseph chose wisely. Joseph's inspiring character remains legendary as a power to forgive came directly from God. Forgiveness isn't always so beautifully given. In the Gospel of Luke, Jesus told a parable of a wasteful son, an unforgiving brother, and a loving father. The young, irresponsible son leaves home, wastes his inheritance in wild living, then returns home broken and worse for wear. Upon seeing his son, the boy's father runs to meet him, embraces his son, kisses him, and calls for a celebration. The older son becomes angry and refuses to join the lavish party. Complaining bitterly to his father, he screams, "You have never given me a young goat so that I might celebrate with my friends. But when the son of yours came, who devoured your wealth with prostitutes, you killed the fattened calf for him." At the conclusion of the story, the older son has forgiven neither his brother nor his father. When we forgive, our attitude changes. Changes of attitude leads to change of behavior. The elder brother in Jesus' parable refuses to forgive his younger brother. He also refuses to forgive his father's conduct. In ugly fashion, his attitude and actions correlate. Mean thoughts and bitter attitudes serve as seeds to produce a harvest of hatred. If ever there was a saying that reminds us of how ideas have consequences, it is this one. Sow a thought, reap a deed. Sow a deed, reap a habit. Sow a habit, reap a character. Sow a character, reap a destiny. Where we spend our eternal destiny can usually be traced back to our thought-loving life. There in our innermost being, we accept or we reject God in our life, therefore sealing our destiny. Self-centeredness, which prevented the older son from being reconciled to his younger brother, prevented reconciliation with his father as well. In the story, the father represents God. By rejecting his father's attitude of reconciliation, the older son was powerless to forgive his brother. When we are right with God, we can forgive and will forgive. When we reject God, any hope of receiving or practicing unconditional forgiveness vanishes. In order to forgive, we must refuse to demonize our adversary. Each of us is loved by God and created in God's image. Still, we are each capable of good and evil. The noted German poet and novelist Goethe confessed that he had never known a crime that he might be incapable of committing. If only that was all so simple. Alexander Schoenstein, a former political prisoner of the communist Soviet Union, if only there were evil people, and it were necessary only to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. But, he sighed, the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. This tells us that both good and evil lie in everyone's heart. The older brother in Jesus' parable wanted power, holding a knife, white-knuckling grip on resentment. He sought to punish his offending brother and unforgiving father. They would pay. Wielding the power of bitterness like a blunt instrument, he hit with the intent to harm. Love, so clearly presented in the father, was missing in the older brother's heart. The power versus the power of the love contrast sharply in the story. Where love rules, there is no will to power, Carl Jung wrote, and where power permeates, the love is lacking. Forgiveness springs from love. However, where love is absent, forgiveness is impossible. You must first love someone before you forgive them. Could there ever come a time or occasion when forgiveness should not be denied or should be denied? In Simon Wiesenthal's haunting book, The Sunflower, the author, a survivor of the Holocaust, tells a story of a young Jew who was taken from a concentration camp to hear the deathbed confession of a Nazi soldier. The soldier, an SS trooper, was haunted horribly by memories of a mass murder in which he participated. Jewish men, women, and children, perhaps many as 200, had been herded into a house. The doors had been locked. Machine guns had been trained on the exits. The house was set ablaze. Anyone who tried to escape would be riddled with bullets. Hand grenades had been thrown through the windows. A man clutching a small child had jumped from a second-story window. The Nazi, who now lay dying, had fired mercifully. A child with black hair and dark eyes haunted him. I cannot die without coming clean, the soldier confessed. I'm here left with my guilt. I want to die in peace, he whispered. I've longed to talk to a Jew and beg forgiveness from him. I know that what I'm asking is almost too much for you, but without your answer, I cannot die in peace. What would you have done? Did the young Jew have the responsibility of extending forgiveness to the confessing murderer? Would you have granted or denied forgiveness to the dying man? Silence filled the room of the dying soldier. Then the young Jew related, "At last, I made up my mind and left without a word from the room." Responses that fall short of forgiveness. Whenever we suffer an injustice, retribution and forgiveness rush to offer themselves as two opposing responses from which we may choose. Of course, we may also choose to ignore the wrong. Reasons for neglecting to ignore wrong may include love, retribution, fear, poor coping skill capabilities, or inadequate conflict management skills. In other words, we may choose to ignore wrong done to us because we fear that we love the person or we fear the person. In addition to ignoring a cruelty, pardoning, condoning, excusing, justifying, or forgetting are all possible reactions to violence on our person. Some of these responses may be motivated by love, others by a sense of fairness, and still others by denial, or for some unfathomable reason. As explained previously, none of these options constitute forgiveness. In order for forgiveness to occur, guilt must be established. Judgment must fall. Excuses are unacceptable. Surely every deed has a cause, but cause doesn't remove responsibility. There is always a story, but not all stories excuse. I did what I did because. I didn't mean to do it. I couldn't help it. I was only following orders. All of these approaches hope to diminish judgment. Reasons and excuses differ. The former hold water. The latter do not. Good friends of mine lost their teenage son in an automobile accident involving alcohol and speeding on the part of another person. For the guilty driver of the car to say, "I didn't mean to do it," could never alter the fact that their accident was their fault. It is true that the death of our friend's son followed what is sometimes referred to as the law of unintended consequences. The inebriated driver surely did not intend to cause the death of an innocent person. Nonetheless, drunk driving is illegal, foolhardy, and merits a strong judgment. Excuses fail, leaving in their wake a crisis of forgiveness. The healthy process. Anytime we suffer injury at the hands of a wrongdoer, we grieve. Grief and loss almost always go hand in hand. As victims, we suffer loss of self-esteem, loss of dignity, loss of possession, loss of health, loss of a dream, loss of loved ones, and a loss of well-being. Therefore, we must work through stages of grief to regain emotional equilibrium. Elizabeth Kübler Ross identifies the stages of grief as denial or shock, anger, bargaining, depression, and finally acceptance. The process of working towards forgiveness should not be rushed. Anger, for example, could take place over years. It's a justifiable response to unfairness. Venting anger may prove to be therapeutic. Suppressing anger, on the other hand, may cause problems later. Let's say you are angry, and every once in a while you lash out. That may prove to be therapeutic at the point, but suppressing anger over a long period of time only causes problems later. Violations of fairness need to be addressed honestly. Feelings should not be suppressed. Premature forgiveness poses a temptation to avoid. Forgiveness is a choice, but is also a process. The process leads, when time is right, to the removal of barriers within a relationship. Resentment is exchanged for goodwill. Sometimes, however, we think we've forgiven when we have not. When we remember a wound that our ego causes, hostilities resurface. The injury has not been forgiven. David replaces Saul as king of Israel. Years later, Shammai, a man of the house of Saul, cursed David publicly and threw stones at him and shouted, get out, you man of bloodshed and worthless fellow. You are taken in your own evil, for you are a man of bloodshed. Abishai, one of the king's servants, begged David, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over now and cut off his head. But David replied, if he curses, and if the Lord has told him, curse David, then who shall say, why have you done so? Let him be alone. Let him curse. Perhaps the Lord will look on after my affliction and return good to me instead of cursing this day. David was portrayed in the Bible as a paragon of virtue, projecting humility, graciousness, patience, understanding, and forgiveness. Sometime later, Shammai came to his senses, fell down before the king, and pleaded for forgiveness. Let not my Lord consider me guilty, nor remember what your servant did wrong on the day when the Lord, the king, came out of Jerusalem, so that the king could take it to heart, for your servant knows that I have sinned. Again, Abishai blurted, should not Shammai be put to death for this, because he cursed the Lord's anointed? And before David rebuked Abishai, then said to Shammai, you shall not die. Years later, as David lay dying in old age, he charged Solomon, his son, who was succeeding him as king. I am going the way of all the earth. Be strong, therefore, and show yourself a man. Keep the charge of the Lord your God to walk in his ways, to keep his statutes, his commandments, his ordinance, his testimonies. David reminded Solomon of God's promise. If your sons are careful in their ways to walk before me in truth with all their heart, with all their soul, you shall not jack a man on the throne of Israel. David appeared to be an exemplar of spirituality. What happened next shocked us. Behold, there is with you Shammai. Now it is he who cursed me with a violent curse on the day that I went to Merom. David breathed to Solomon, but when he came down to meet me at Jordan, I swore to him by the Lord, saying, I will not put you to death with the sword. David insisted, do not let him go unpunished, for you are a wise man, and you will know what ought to be done to him, and you will bring his gray hair down to Sheol with blood. Following David's death, Solomon honored his father's deathbed request by executing Shammai. Before his execution, the allegedly forgave the man, heard these words, you know all the evil which you did to my father, David. Therefore, the Lord shall return your evil onto your head. So Shammai died. So much for David's legacy of a model of forgiveness. You must admit that it is true that David passionately sought God's forgiveness following his adultery with Bathsheba and his subsequent successful plot to have her husband killed. In fact, Psalms 51, attributed to David during those days, remains the prince of the penal psalms. So what went wrong with the case of Shammai? If David should swallow his pride and seek forgiveness for God, why should he not grant forgiveness to Shammai? First, we must admit we do not know the entire story. We know only what we know, based on what we read. However, David may not have allowed a healthy progress of grief to run its course. By that I mean his earlier alleged forgiveness may have been premature. David never gave expression to any feelings of hurt, humiliation, or hostility towards Shammai. Rather, he apparently suppressed his true feelings. Anger, shame, and resentment never surfaced, even though he was cursed viciously and pelted with stones. He never addressed Shammai regarding the injustice of his attack. David pressed no charges. He levied no penalty. He made no move to ensure his protection against a future attack. He treated the matter far too lightly, it seems. An injustice politely ushered out the back door during the daylight offered return in the night to kick down the door front. Cheap forgiveness brings expensive bills. David paid far too much for his show of cheap grace. As for poor Shammy, cheap grace cost him his life. As David's deathbed words revealed, he harbored incensed anger over Shemuel's violation of him. However, David never confronted Shemuel about the matter. Furthermore, when Shemuel approached him, David declined the opportunity for honest dialogue. For without honest dialogue, forgiveness cannot occur. And without honest dialogue, forgiveness is too premature. Nor did he, as far as we know, verbalize his rage to God or anyone else over his wrongs. Left undressed, the open wound festered. By refusing to forgive, David forfeited peace of mind, peace with others, and peace with God. Perhaps David was depressed. Unresolved conflict and anger turn inward, invite depression. Like any of us who has ever had a crisis of forgiveness, David needed God's help. Depression comes when you have unresolved conflict or you are struggling with forgiveness. God's finest example. One of my professors in seminary called attention to our flawed pattern of problem solving. When we find ourselves stressed to the edge of our limits, he said, our first line of defense is try to handle the crisis ourselves. When that fails, he noticed, we turn to others for help. When relief still doesn't come, at last we resort to cry out to God for help. Wouldn't it be good, he lamented, if we reverse the order? In prayer, as with all of life, honesty is the best policy. An honest prayer may begin, Lord, help me to want to forgive. Help me to want to do this, because right now I don't even want to. We must start with prayer before the want can occur. Maybe if the Lord can change our hearts so that we want to do something or we want to forgive, he can then lead us to take the next step and the next until we have forgiven. God is love. Therefore, love is the unifying principle of the created order. Violations of love plunge creation into chaos. Order becomes disorder. Orientation collapses into disorientation, which in turn cries out for reorientation. Only love, unselfish love, agape love, gives birth to forgiveness. Only forgiveness can remove barriers within a relationship caused by wrongdoing. Only forgiveness can rid our souls of resentment. Only forgiveness can save us from the poison of revenge. Again, only forgiveness, when rendered, will rid our soul of resentment. So why forgive? Because nothing else will work. Nothing else will give us the power of peace. Nothing else can take that hardened heart and turn it light towards God. The single most powerful illustration of love and forgiveness that I am familiar with comes from Jesus on the cross. I'm totally disarmed by this loving act. While we were killing him, he loved us and he forgave us. Surely he must have been tempted to go, I want to get you back. To be sure, Jesus was no militant Christ. He had expressed his feelings strongly and honestly all along the way to the cross. To the high priest who questioned him cynically, he replied, Why do you question me? Question those who you have heard what I spoke to them. They know what I said. To the Roman officer who struck him for speaking defiantly to the high priest, he demanded, if I have spoken wrongly, testify of the wrong. But if I have rightly, why do you strike me? To Pilate, who jeered, do you not know what I have the authority to release you? That I have the authority to crucify you? He rebutted, you would have no authority over me unless I had been given you from above. Even to God, with whom he felt he had deserted him, he cried, my God, why have you forsaken me? Yet his grace is impossible to miss, and for me, impossible to resist. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do, prayed the crucified one. I don't know what to do with what amazing grace that is, except melt. We are killing him, and he loved us and forgave us. He sees me at my worst, but he loves me anyway. That changes me. I not only repent of my evil ways, but I accept myself, dark side and all, knowing that my worst has been exposed and that I am still loved. A true miracle is that I want to love others the way that I am loved. Christ is contagious. I want to love the way that Christ loves. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another as I have loved you, and that you also love one another. Such love empowers forgiveness for others. When in humanness, we are tempted to turn our backs on love and forgiveness, there is a place we can go for help. That place is a person. For we do not have high priest who cannot sympathize with our weakness, but one who has been tempted in all things as we are, yet without sin. Therefore, let us draw near with confidence to the throne of grace, so that we may be received in mercy and find grace to help in the one that we need. Lord Jesus, help us to forgive others as you have forgiven us.